morning, counsel.
Thank you. May it please the court, I'm Anthony Steinmeier from the Department of Justice. I represent the appellant in this case, the Secretary of HHS. The district court held that a Medicare reimbursement manual provision was invalid under this court's doctrine of paralyzed veterans because it was issued without notice and comment. Unless the court prefers otherwise, I propose to approach these arguments in three steps. First, to show that the rule in question was actually an interpretive rule. It's not a substantive rule masquerading or improperly labeled as a substantive rule. And because that's true, under the Supreme Court's decision of Guernsey and this court's decision in American Mining Congress, its notice and comment were not required. Then I plan to move to the conflicting doctrine of paralyzed veterans that said notice and comment is required for some interpretive rulings, and show that we, even under that doctrine, we fit within the three exceptions to that paralyzed veterans doctrine, and so notice and comment would not be required there. And then finally, turn to the merits, which Montefiore raises as an alternative ground for affirmance. So first of all, the issue about whether the manual provision is indeed an interpretive rule, the basic distinction was set forth by the Supreme Court in Chrysler. Legislative rules have the force and effect of law. Interpretive rules don't.
Well, hasn't this one been treated as if it did have the force and effect of law?
I don't
think.
That
is to say, the Secretary seems to have conducted the computation as to what the petitioner would be entitled for reimbursement on based upon this rule as if this is a binding norm. That's why we're here.
Yeah. Well, yes.
If she hadn't done that, or her predecessor and her subordinate hadn't done that, then we wouldn't be here, would we?
Well, let me approach that and try to break that down. First of all, the deputy administrator, wrote a 16-page decision. Mm-hmm. He did, in the end, follow the practice of the interpretive rule, but the rule on itself states it's not binding. The Provider Reimbursement Review Board didn't consider itself bound by it. So, in effect, I think it's that adjudication applying the interpretation that stands or falls in this case.
Are you going to talk about the retroactivity question, too?
Well, I can now. That was taken care of in St. Francis. That the problem is the manual provision was issued in 1994. We're dealing with Medicare cost years of 1991 and 1993. But the Montefiore did not apply for the exception until after 1994. So that's what that's why the 1994 provision was applied. The St. Francis case recognized that and held it, and especially, going back to Judge Santel's question, especially if it's the adjudication that matters and that the interpretive rule really does not have binding a force of law, then there should not be any retroactivity problem. In contrast to legislative rules, like the Georgetown Hospital case, where the Supreme Court said legislative regulations cannot be applied retroactively.
But do you know of any cases that say that Bowen doesn't apply to interpretive rules? I mean, the provision that defines a rule in the APA doesn't distinguish between interpretive or legislative. It says, and this is one of the bases. It says, a rule is whatever it is, right? Of having future effect,
right?
So it can't have retroactive effect, and that applies to interpretive and legislative rules,
right? Again, St. Francis is right in point on that, the Sixth Circuit case, and what it said, it's applied prospectively to each.
Well, that's a different question. I mean, whether it is in fact retroactive is one question, but I thought I heard you to say that since this is an interpretive rule, that the anti-retroactivity principle of Bowen doesn't apply.
I'd better amend that then.
Okay.
To say it was not applied retroactively here because the key date is not the 1991 or 1993 cost year. It's when the date that Montefiore applied for the exception, that was after issuance of this PRB manual provision.
I got you a little sidetracked, and you
Okay, well, let's go back and say, is this indeed an interpretive rule, or is it a legislative rule masquerading as an interpretive rule?
That's the part that bothers me. Is it a legislative rule in masquerading as an interpretive rule?
Okay.
Is it plain from the record that it was not treated as a binding norm when the computations were made about which the petitioner is now complaining?
I submit it was, and again, at least that's what the manual itself in its foreword says. These provisions don't have the force of law. The Supreme Court in Guernsey...
That could be a masquerade. You're not out of the masquerade problem.
I guess that's right, and that's correct. But again, the fact that the administrator wrote a lengthy decision, and that would be where the explanation has to come forward.
Does the decision offer another explanation for the use of the 112% norm as opposed to cost norm besides this interpretive, quote-unquote, interpretive rule?
I'm not sure I follow all the implications of that question, but what the interpretive rule says is trying to do is implement Congress's decision back in...
Congress was not dealing with atypical...
No, it wasn't. But it was dealing with reimbursement.
It was dealing with reimbursement to the hospital-based
skilled nurse
SNFs, but
right.
It was not dealing with atypical provision. Not only would you certainly have an interpretive rule, but you might even need an interpretive rule. But it wasn't.
Yes. It was dealing with reimbursement.
But not this type of reimbursement.
Rather than breaking it down between routine and atypical, I would break it down into such things as nursing costs, food costs, all those groups of activities that constitute routine costs. Now, what Congress said was that it wasn't going to reimburse everything in those categories for hospital-based skilled nursing facilities because it thought some of it, 50%, was due to inefficiencies.
Now, is that plainly applicable to atypical in the absence of this interpretive rule?
This quote-unquote interpretive rule. Well, before the interpretive ruling, it was not applied, as best we can tell, in the administrative decisions, and the Eighth Circuit said. But if it's not applied, the Secretary winds up reimbursing exactly the same costs under the guise of calling them atypical costs that Congress said don't reimburse as routine costs. So that was the basis of the St. Francis decision that upheld this on the merits, that you don't want...
St. Luke's struck it down on the merits.
That's right.
One circuit going one way and one going the other. When the saints go marching in, they're not marching to the same drummer on this.
They're going a clear conflict on the merits.
Here's my problem. First of all, this business about it, that it doesn't... this is not law. This is just something else. It's totally circular, but courts have recognized that. But anyway, I don't know what you're interpreting. What this manual? What does this interpret?
That's a good question. What it interprets is first, it interprets the statute that says the secretary may, in his discretion, grant exceptions, and then it interprets the legislative regulation, which is also discretionary, and says exceptions.
What words in the regulation is this supposedly interpreting?
Reasonable.
But reasonable costs still have to be determined.
Yes.
All this regulation does, manual thing does is say that the reimbursement gap shall operate as a deductible against reasonable costs.
Right.
Right?
But
that doesn't change the meaning of reasonable costs. It just says we're going to apply this reimbursement gap as a deductible.
What you just said, I think, is decisive, and that is this provision does not change the meaning of reasonable. That means it's not masquerading as an attempt to amend that legislative rule, which means it's interpretive, not substantive.
Interpreting the regulation, is that what you say?
Yes.
And, you know, it seems to me that your brief contradicts itself on this point.
It may be, but I'm not sure.
It's page 26.
Okay.
You say the dispute in this case is not about the meaning of the regulation.
Right.
But about a new application of the regulation to a changed situation which calls for a different policy.
Yes.
Well, if it's not a question of the meaning of the regulation, then you don't have an interpretive rule.
What it interprets is the word reasonable has to be given some specific content. And matter of fact, American Mining Congress says, well, that's the purpose of informal rules. All the time you'll have, there must be lots of Medicare regulations, for example, that says the secretary is limited to reimbursing reasonable costs in one form or another. That has to be given some content. You have to, at the end, Medicare has to come up with a dollar amount of what it's going to pay Medicare providers. And that's what the provider reimbursement manual does. The Supreme Court said in Guernsey that that kind of action, going from a general reasonableness test of a regulation or a statute to a specific formula, either a specific dollar amount or some kind of specific formula to calculate a dollar amount, that's what interpretive rules such as manual provisions do.
There's a line of authority for the proposition, and forget about the Chrysler case and the others that talk about rules of law, that says, and I wonder if you agree with this, that says when you get a provision in a manual or a guidance or a regulation that deals with numbers, that you're really not, it's not an interpretive, that's a legislative type rule. And there's a famous case that Judge Posner wrote about a 6-foot-high fence and 8-foot. You're familiar with the Hockney
case. I'm familiar
case.
With that one. Yeah. But
now wait a minute.
I'm sorry.
I tried to figure out the formula that this guidance or this policy manual says, and I came up with an algebraic expression of this. It's 1.12y minus X times 1.12 minus Y times 1.12 over 2, with X being the mean for non-hospital and Y being the mean for the hospital-related. Now, that doesn't sound, under this line of authority, it doesn't sound like an interpretive rule. It sounds like a numbers.
Okay. There's a famous case in this court, American Mining Congress, that goes exactly the opposite, and it says, If all that interpretive rules did was were repeat the vague standards of reasonableness, they're mush. What good's that? You have to get from a general standard.
Yeah, I'm talking about the numbers thing. We don't have any cases
actually,
to deal with that.
Actually, American Mining Congress, after it says that, cites a case for a formula for computing retirement benefits. So the specificity, going from the general to the specific, is what the Medicare reimbursement manual is supposed to do and does do. And it did it in the Guernsey case, where it's dealing with generally accepted accounting principles. It did it in American Mining Congress, where the regulation was also, the interpretive rule was specific.
Would I be correct in characterizing the manual as saying that the reimbursement gap, that 50%, shall be deducted from reasonable costs incurred for atypical expenses? That's the rule.
Yes, I think that's correct. But in the end, again, the overriding purpose was what St. Francis said. If you don't do it that way, you wind up reimbursing exactly the same types of cost as Congress said you shouldn't reimburse. Now, maybe you call them atypical rather than typical, but that's not the important thing. The important thing is whether you carry out Congress's judgment that half these costs are due to inefficiency. So that's, by all that, especially if I'm certain that American Mining Congress deals with the point you raised directly, and I'll see if I can't find that and refer you to the exact page number, but in the meantime, let me move on to the interesting question. So we're all agreed that if this is masquerading as an interpretive rule, but in effect it's a legislative rule, notice and comment are required under the Supreme Court law of Guernsey and under this court's decision of American Mining Congress. That's not what the district court said. The district court said this is an interpretation, but the reason notice and comment are required is because it amended a prior policy. Right. And that, it said, was enough to invoke paralyzed veterans. So our second point is that was a mistake. That was error because of the three exceptions to the paralyzed paralyzed veterans doctrine that this court has enunciated, although two of the cases we rely on, Devron and Met West, were decided after the district court's decision in this case. But the first one is the original paralyzed veterans doesn't apply because there wasn't a definitive and binding statement by someone who was authorized to bind it.
What about the Sacramento decision?
That dealt with a prior statute, Your Honor.
But did it change in any material way? I mean, it said that atypical costs were reimbursed in full.
That was true under the before the statute. That was before the Deficit Reduction Act. That was true.
But has the regulation changed in any way that relates to this question?
Yes, the background.
Material way.
It still used the same word.
Reasonable. Right. Exactly. That's the point.
But the interpretation of the regulation
And 35
was carried out. Right. Or what does reasonable mean? And
2534 reversed Sacramento.
Really, I'd say Congress reversed.
Congress left it. Congress left the secretary with discretion to keep it in place. In fact, you did for 10 years.
Well, there was a delay in implementing. I grant you that. things move slowly,
go on to another question. I'll come back to
perhaps,
it.
Perhaps I could add an alternative reason, and that is this court has recognized that the administrator says that not even its adjudicatory decisions, such as Sacramento, are binding in future cases. Now, that raises some problems. I think I cited the case in our brief. I believe it was Community Hospital. So it's not just that the provider reimbursement review decisions only bind the agency for that particular case. Even an adjudicatory decision on a provider claim is not doesn't have that stare decisis effect.
Why?
The secretary, I guess, imposed.
You cite that provision of this provider reimbursement manual. What's it called? PRB, right?
Yes.
That says that they don't have precedential effect. Is that your point?
It says it doesn't have the effect of a regulation, so it's not binding in that sense.
Is it binding as an adjudication?
No, and that's strange. You could say one difference between an interpretive rule, a legislative rule binds the public. It imposes duties on the public or regulated people. Interpretive rules don't do that, but at least you might think, well, they at least announce to the public they bind the agency.
The Sacramento decision was never followed?
I'm sorry?
The Sacramento decision was never followed by other?
I don't know. I can't answer that. It's the only example that Montefiore cites. Whether it was followed before Congress enacted the new statute, I just don't know the answer to that, Your Honor.
You argue against the Alaskan professional hunters?
Yes, we do, Your Honor.
We do, yeah. Do you realize that four Supreme Court justices adopted that principle in the Geyer versus America Honda?
Yes,
and that Justice Alito, who was not on the court then, also adopted it in an opinion for the Third Circuit?
Well, I read that Caruso opinion in the Third Circuit by Justice Alito, I think, is very important because he first adopted it. He just followed it. Then on a petition for rehearing, he rewrites the opinion and doesn't rely on the rationale of Alaska Hunter. He cites it, but he relies on the rationale of the Supreme Court.
Well, five justices have agreed with it, right?
No.
Four plus one?
No.
I guess Justice Souter left, so.
No, Your Honor. There were four. And by the way, there wasn't any analysis there. They were just deferring to the expertise of this court. And if they analyzed, I think,
A wise thing for them.
A wise thing. And because, after all, take a look at what they say. A unanimous court in Vermont Yankee says you cannot impose new procedures. And that's exactly what I
thought. Rulemaking is a new procedure?
What?
Rulemaking is a new procedure?
Requiring notice and comment for interpretive rules is a new procedure. Yes, Your Honor. And it's a new procedure that flies in the teeth of of the rulemaking provision of APA.
It's not an interpretive rule if what it's doing is amending a regulation, right?
That's Guernsey. That's correct. But it can give context to what reasonable means, and it can change that context to take into account. Congress said, "Don't stop reimbursing these costs." And so there's a clear conflict between Alaska hunters and paralyzed veterans on whether or not rulemaking.
How many other circuits have adopted the paralyzed veteran rationale?
Only one that I know of, the First Circuit, and I've counted at least four that have gone the other way. But forget about that.
On which specific point have they gone the other way? On what specific point have they gone the other way?
Just that interpretive rules do not require notice and comment. All interpretive rules. And by the way, Alaska hunters relied on the definition of interpretive rule. It says that definition says interpretive rules include rules that formulate new policy or revise or repeal. And then you look at the rulemaking provision, and it said notice and comment's not required for interpretive rules. And so, as Professor Feer said, that means it's not required for rules that reverse or change interpretive rules. A flat-out conflict.
I see that the, at least according to one law review article that I've read, that the third, the second, the sixth, have all adopted it, and district courts throughout the country have too. You know what article I'm talking about?
I'm not sure.
Administrative law review. Yeah.
I'm sorry, but the cases are some of the cases are gathered in a recent 11th Circuit case, Washer, Warshauer at 577 Fed 3rd. Now, when I looked at them, I thought they got the count wrong. So who knows exactly what the count is? There's a conflict. Everybody agrees with that. But I would just point out how can anybody disagree when Vermont Yankee reversed this court for doing exactly what you did in paralyzed veterans with respect? That is, the APA says no interpretive rules require notice and comment, and this court said, oh, yes, some do.
Vermont Yankee is a very different situation. What the court did then, and it was a practice of the D.C. Circuit, is to vacate decisions in that case by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and then send the case back and say, now, we're not telling you how to have your hearings, but if you did it this way, it would be a good idea. And if you allowed this and you allowed that and so on and so forth, there was no direct holding about procedures. It was simply all these suggestions, and that was a technique that the D.C. Circuit used. And so when I filed the cert petition in Vermont Yankee for the Solicitor General's office, it was quite clear to say that this was a way of the D.C. Circuit trying to evade its proper authority.
Well, let me read one sentence for you.
You would never find this court to do that today.
Right.
Well,
you were in the Department of Justice then. You know
that's
that.
That's right.
I worked with you on that.
But on Vermont Yankee, let me just close with this. This is the one.
None of us heard that.
When you go back to chambers, Your Honor, I would ask you to read the Vermont Yankee. I believe it's page 535, and let me just read it. It said the court, meaning this court, then examined the rulemaking procedures, and despite the fact that it appeared that the agency employed all the procedures required by 5 U.S.C. 553 and more, the court determined that the proceedings to be inadequate and overturned the rule. And Justice Scalia, in his well-known 1978 Law Review article in the Supreme Court Review, said, it gave you a tongue-lashing for not doing that. Now, Justice Scalia said he doubted that you would follow Vermont Yankee, and I think it turned out he was right. But now's your chance. Now's your chance to reduce that.
I'm still left with a little question about the possible masquerade.
Right.
You keep citing American Mining Congress, and rightly so, but the first item listed by Judge Williams in that case is whether in the absence of the rule there would not be an adequate legislative basis for enforcement action or other agency action to confer benefits or ensure the performance of duties. If that interpretive rule in this case is the basis for the computation made in the conferral of benefits, that is to say the reimbursement, why doesn't that come under the first item that was set forth in American Mining Congress.
It doesn't, because compare that to American Mining. American Mining said regulated parties shall keep such records as the Secretary requires. If the Secretary doesn't require them, there's no duty. But in this case...
Conferral of benefits.
Yeah, right.
Of benefits. Here you've got a reimbursement that would seem to be come within the rubric of conferral of benefits. Now, it doesn't get you out of it to say it's not as strong a case for a petitioner as American Mining Congress was.
Right.
That one was very strong.
But I think there is a clear distinction because here, well, first of all, before 1994, the Secretary was paying benefits here, a typical cost.
Right.
And what was the basis for that? It was the statute, which admittedly is discretionary. The Secretary may, in his discretion, to the extent he deems appropriate. And then there was this regulation, still a regulation, that says, and he can do this as long as he doesn't pay unreasonable costs. There's a ceiling. He can't go above reasonableness.
So that gets us to the 6-foot or 8-foot high fence of...
My recollection there isn't strong enough, but what it means is even without the manual provision, the Secretary had legal authority to pay these atypical costs.
They have the authority to compute them in the manner in which they were computed here.
Yes. Now, he didn't do it before the congressional statute.
It had never been done before and wasn't done for years and years, and then it's done. And the reliance is upon this, what you're now calling an interpretive rule, makes it sound as if perhaps they couldn't have done it that way without that rule, which arguably could make it legislative. It might not, but it arguably.
I would come down on the might not side because whenever you change an interpretive rule, it sets that goes from a general standard to a specific, so you come up with a different specific standard. That's the purpose of interpretive rules. So you're back to the paralyzed veteran doctrine that once you make an interpretation, you're locked in for all time unless you can't change it unless you go through notice and comment.
I just want to ask you a question about the merits. Montefiore argues in its brief that at pages 24 or 25, that the regulation is arbitrary and capricious because the justification the agency gave for this was the congressional judgment that hospital-based skilled nursing facilities are less efficient.
Yes.
But that said nothing whatsoever about atypical costs. That only related to routine costs.
Right.
And that there's no factual basis for this regulation on atypical costs.
Well,
you didn't answer that. At least I didn't see.
That the key distinction is not between atypical and typical. The key distinction is what do you reimburse, say, for these routine costs?
No, it is significant from their point of view because prior to this regulation, they were reimbursed 100%
right.
for atypical costs, and now they're not.
Right.
And so that's the material distinction, isn't it? And there's nothing in the congressional report that, we don't even have the congressional report, but there's nothing in it that anybody suggests that relates to the atypical cost question.
Right.
So why aren't they right that it's arbitrary and capricious?
Rather than looking at the distinction between typical and atypical, I think the important distinction is to look, what should they be reimbursed for nursing? What should they be reimbursed for food?
Well, what's your answer to my question? That prior to this new regulation, it was 100%
right.
for atypical, and now it's not. And
right.
why isn't that? I mean, I don't think you can answer that by saying, well, there are other distinctions. Why isn't that the distinction that's important here in terms of justifying this new regulation?
Well it is important, but if the agency did not change its interpretation, it allows a reimbursement for the same cost that Congress said don't reimburse by just saying, well,
nobody is saying, not even petitioner is saying, that the agency couldn't change its interpretation.
Right.
They're saying that it hasn't properly changed its interpretation.
Right, because they didn't go through notice and comment.
Right.
Well, no, I was asking...
And did not make a record of why this is changed. The reasons you're offering today may be very good reasons, if there were record reasons, if the Secretary's delegee, rather than you, were making them.
But. Well, let me approach that, and let me tie that into MetWest. The recent MetWest said what the core of Alaska hunters is all about is protecting reliance interests, and that's a legitimate interest. Now, how does this, but the Supreme Court has a different way. Protecting reliance interests is a substantive concern. The Supreme Court and the APA protect that by a substantive test. Has the agency acted in an arbitrary and capricious way? Alaska hunters protects it by a procedural way. We'll make the agency jump through notice and comment. So in the
purpose of notice and comment is record making.
Yes.
And the substantive test is also based on the record.
I'm sorry.
The substantive test is also based on what's in the record. So either way, do we really have the record explanation here for the reasons for this change?
There you look to the administrator's decision when he applied the interpretive regulation.
But he relied on the congressional study.
Yes,
and the congressional study
doesn't do it.
Doesn't do it.
And in fact, in Montefiore's brief, Montefiore's brief, they say, to the extent there is any evidence of congressional intent, it's that they expected the HHS to continue the 100% reimbursement for atypical costs.
But
they cite this Finance Committee report for that. And none of that's responded to in your brief.
Yes, sir. That Finance Committee just says we assume you'll reimburse reasonable costs. And the administrator says it's not reasonable to reimburse costs that Congress says are due to inefficiencies. So the legislative history doesn't get them out. The literal language of the statute would trump the legislative history, and the literal language of the regulation and the statute are both discretionary, not mandatory.
My point was not I was making a statutory point.
I'm sorry?
I wasn't making a statutory point.
Okay.
I was only focusing on Montefiore's argument that the report that the administrator relied on doesn't support the decision with respect to atypical costs. That was my only point.
Now, I don't think that's correct. The administrator...
Well, is there any evidence that the congressional report, when it talked about the difference between hospital-based and self-standing nursing facilities, inefficiencies, the comparable inefficiencies, was focusing on atypical costs?
No,
they were
just...
Well, that's their
certainly
point.
Not, it was certain...
That's their point.
It wasn't, nor would it be focused on typical cost. It was focused on nursing care. It was focused on food. It was focused on what you pay for, regardless of whether you label it typical or atypical. So why would Congress say we don't want to reimburse all of these costs for hospital-based nursing facilities for food and so on? Because some of it's due to inefficiency.
It's perfectly likely, and maybe this is exactly the case, where you have a hospital-based facility who is operating efficiently with respect to its atypical costs.
Yep.
This may be that. That's what they claim they are.
That was the Eighth Circuit's decision.
No, I don't know.
I'm just talking about
this case. And you were saying why it wouldn't make any sense. Well, I was saying, well, why not? Why couldn't you have a hospital that, with respect to its normal arrangements, its normal costs, is less efficient than self-standing self-standing skilled nursing facilities, but with respect to its atypical costs, that is, its unusual patients, it's functioning very efficiently.
Let me answer the why not. And the why not is Congress makes a systemic finding that, for some reason, all hospital...
But there's no evidence in this report that... They say there's no evidence that they were focusing on atypical, and that's a completely different category.
They may be wrong, but the record does not make that abundantly clear to us.
What the record does make clear is Congress changed the statute. It used to be that hospital-based nursing facilities got their full cost, are up to the limit.
Got the same as
freestanding. Congress said, well, wait a minute. How come hospital-based skilled nursing facilities costs are always so much higher? And they had the study, not in the record, but we know there's no doubt about what Congress did. In the Deficit Reduction Act, it cuts back on the reimbursement for hospital-based skilled nursing facilities. Now, what possible ground would it do that? And that's because
one ground would be that we'll do that and on the routine stuff, but we're still going to let them have the atypical costs.
But isn't that irrational that you take from one hand and give to the other hand?
No, it isn't irrational at all for the reasons that Judge Arnold asserted in the Eighth Circuit and Judge Tatel and Judge Randolph right there. It may be that you could make a record showing that it's not the most rational, not reasonable, not the best way, or not the way that the Secretary will approve, but on what we have, no, it's not inherently irrational that there could be that distinction between the hospital's efficiencies with reference to routine and the hospital's efficiencies with reference to atypical. It isn't inherent that those have to be the same.
Well, I guess that shouldn't be the test.
Maybe it shouldn't.
The test should be, is it permissible for the Secretary to say, Congress has made the systemic finding that hospital-based nursing facilities have higher costs. This statute cut back on that reimbursement. Now, if we use if we just say, well, we're going to give them back the same amount of money, but we're going to call it an atypical cost rather than a typical, a reasonable interpretation is they have defeated the purpose of the statute by doing that. That's good enough. It doesn't have to be the best. It's good enough.
We've kept you up an unconscionable amount of time here. My colleagues have further questions.
Right.
Go ahead.
I'm not catching a bite.
You agree, do you not, that under Fox, you rely heavily on FCC versus Fox?
Yes.
The Supreme Court's decision last term. And you agree, do you not, that one of the things that was incumbent upon the agency was to take into account any reliance interests on the previous rule?
Yes.
Right, okay.
Yes.
But this is a very simple question. That's true, and Justice Scalia goes into a whole big deal about what is required in terms of an explanation for changing course, right?
Right.
But what I find puzzling about that case is that Justice Kennedy's vote was needed to make a majority, and he filed a concurring opinion saying he agrees with the dissent.
Sorry, I don't have an explanation for that.
I don't either. Who do we look to, Breyer or Scalia, to find the governing rule?
Well, I thought it was a titled opinion of the court, per Justice Scalia.
I know, but he said concurring, I agree with the dissent.
I'm sorry. But the one key thing there is that Justice Scalia said, deal with it by requiring an explanation in the adjudicative format. When the interpretative rule is applied, deal with it that way. Don't make the agency jump through the procedural hoop for issuing interpretive rules when the APA says not to. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear from the appellee.
Let me gather up my library here.
Take your time. We're not catching any buses either. Good morning, Mr. Berry.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Dennis Berry, representing Montefiore Medical Center. The foundation for the government's case and for the policy, manual section 2534, is an oft-repeated statement that there were multiple studies in the mid-80s saying that hospital-based skilled nursing facilities were inefficient, and half of their costs were attributable, or half to the extent that their costs exceeded freestanding facilities, half of the difference relates to inefficiency. And that is a fiction. Or if it's true, we sure can't find it in the record. We have a citation to a report in the record, but we have no report in the record. And we haven't been able to find that report. Incidentally, the first reference to that report in the proceedings at the agency came at the very last step, at the administrator's decision. We have looked for that report, and what we have found is a report that says, an executive summary of that report that was published in a 1985 Senate document, It says sufficient information is currently not available to quantify the proportion, the reasons for the cost difference. And we've quoted that in our brief on page 25. Mr. Steinmeier was discussing what the 1985 report said and didn't said. I am clueless as to how he could have done that. I would love to talk to you about the 1985 report, but I can't. And the reason we can is not only is it not in the adjudicatory record of this case, we don't have a rulemaking record because the agency chose not to go through rulemaking. And it appears, based on what we do know about these reports, that had the agency gone through rulemaking, had this report been out there, or these reports, whatever they are, that they're subject to some comments saying, no, they don't really say what you say they're saying. I mean, what we have says we don't have sufficient information. But we didn't have the opportunity to make any rulemaking comments. Now let's turn to the facts that are in the record. There's no dispute that Montefiore Medical Center Skilled Nursing Facility, incidentally, Montefiore is a 1,200-bed hospital in the North Bronx. Its skilled nursing facility was an 80-bed facility that's on the campus. There's no dispute that it furnished atypical services, and not just a little atypical, a lot atypical. Of 186 facilities in New York State, the record reports that Montefiore was in the top 3% for acuity. There's no dispute that the individual costs by those categories that Mr. Steinmeier was referring to, direct nursing, maintenance and operation of plant, there's 13 categories, have been scrutinized by the agency and have been found to relate to the atypical services that were furnished. And there's no dispute that if Montefiore were a freestanding nursing facility, every penny that's in dispute in this case would have been reimbursed. All right, where is the dispute in this case on the reasonableness of cost? A critical fact is that the specific costs have been examined dime by dime, and the request for exception was an extraordinarily thick document. The narrative was 80 or more pages, and it had reams of supporting financial information. That has been scrutinized. And the agency's process, as described in the administrator's decision, is a two-step process. The first step is an examination of the reasonableness of the amount of the provider's actual cost. The second step is a comparison of those costs to the peer group mean. So we wouldn't be here if we didn't already have an agency finding that the specific cost in this case...
Oh, you'd be here anyway. You'd find something.
Sir, my client would far prefer not to have me here. So how do reasonable costs morph into being unreasonable costs? And it's Orwellian. It's simply definitional. The agency is saying we declare these costs to be unreasonable. What the statute says is that the secretary may make adjustments. Well, the government has argued that, well, doesn't that give the agency discretion? And of course, the agency always has some discretion. But the statute has always had in it, since 1966, a prohibition against the cross-subsidization of non-governmental patients by Medicare or vice versa. And what the statute says, and we've put this in our brief, is the necessary cost of efficiently delivering covered services to Medicare beneficiaries will not be borne by individuals not so covered. Once you have a finding that the costs are necessary in efficiently delivering services, this provision bars you from not paying them. And nothing that happened in 1984 repealed this portion of the statute. It still stands today. Well, we've moved beyond reasonable cost payment for skilled nursing facilities.
Well, it's in tension with the 50% deductible.
Mm-hmm. We don't know, but I can make an inference. And we don't know, again, not for lack of having looked, but the legislative history does not discuss it. We don't know what Congress had in front of it. This legislation was passed in the spring of 1984. The first written report that we have any reference to, actually it's only referred to, was in the 1985 Senate document. They referred to a draft report having been submitted in October of 1984.
This is the missing report you talked about?
The missing report. And the earliest draft that we see referenced is October, 6 months after the law was enacted. But presumably, and this is what the agency has said, the Congress was aware of some of these studies. So what I infer is that Congress said, maybe there's an issue here, we don't know, but here's what we're going to do. We're going to reduce the limit for hospital-based skilled nursing facilities, and then if those hospitals can come in and support the reasonableness of their cost based upon the individualized exception process that existed going back for years, then they can get their cost up to the full amount of their actual reasonable cost. And that's what the legislative history said. It could not have been more clear that both hospital-based and freestanding facilities could receive, where justified, up to all of their reasonable cost. And if the Congress said something else, the agency should have done something about it in 1984 and 1985. This is not a contemporaneous interpretation we're dealing with. It came 10 years later.
Can you help me out? I'm a bit confused about the formula, how this works. I want to try to go through this in my mind. You take 112% of the mean of the non-hospital, right? And that's the non-hospital-related nursing facilities limit, right?
Yes, sir.
112% of their mean.
Yes.
And then if you take 112% of the hospital-related services, right, that had been, until the amendment, that had been the limit of the hospital-related reimbursement.
Yes, sir.
Right? Okay. Now what you're doing as a result of the amendment is you're subtracting the 112% of the hospital's mean, you're subtracting from that the non-hospital 112%, and then taking 50% of the difference and deducting it from what you give the hospitals?
Yes.
Is that the way it works?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
And let me give an example to be sure that we're saying the same thing.
Okay.
If the per diem limitation, the 112% of mean for freestanding facilities is $100, and the 112% of the mean for hospital-based facilities is $150 per diem, the limitation established for hospital-based facilities would have been $125, which would be half of the difference.
See, that's what I don't understand. The $100 mean is not the limitation, it would be 112, because you have to multiply it by 1.12.
Weren't you assuming in your hypothetical that that's what that $100 is, 112 is?
Yes, sir.
That's what you were assuming.
It's the mean times 100.
In other words, the actual cost is like 90.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I'm leading up to a question. Here's my question, and maybe I don't understand the way this thing functions. But let's suppose that you, representing a hospital, right, ask for reimbursement, and you get up to the limit, however one calculates it, the regular limit, through your routine costs. Okay, then above that 150 or whatever the number was, are the atypical costs. Now, in that situation, there's the reimbursement gap is a deductible, but it's not being deducted against the atypical costs, is it?
It's the way the exception relief is computed. I'm trying to answer your question. Well, we have a chart in our brief. It's on page 9 of the brief. And we've assumed that we've justified cost up to $200, that the limit is at $150.
Are you talking about routine now or atypical?
This would be
routine.
A cost, well, The costs aren't broken down between routine and atypical, because, I mean, routine cost would be nursing costs, for example, but those routine costs are higher
become
when you have
an atypical on the patient base.
Yes.
I see.
But see, my question is that if you get up to your limit with just routine costs, right, and then your atypical costs drive you past what the limit would be, that in that situation there's going to be a deductible, but it's not theoretically a deductible against atypical costs, is it?
Well, our view of how this ought to be done, Your Honor, is that you first determine are there atypical services, and you then figure out what the cost is of those atypical services and add that to the limit. The agency's methodology is not that, and we're not arguing over that, because we'd end up at being at the same point, is that we have justified all of our cost, and under the reasonable cost provision, that cross-subsidization provision.
The atypical costs drive up the limit. That's the way you think it should be done. But in that situation, why shouldn't there be a deductible against the routine costs?
Because there's no distinction. Congress did not enact the statute to penalize hospitals, or there's no evidence that Congress was trying to penalize hospitals. And therefore, when they have the justified cost, they should get up to their full reasonable cost. Otherwise, it would be violating the cross-subsidization portion of the statute.
It'd be better if we had a blackboard and some chalk here.
Well,
I'm not going to help all that much.
We also are relying upon the literal wording of the regulation, which, as we noted, was not changed to reflect any differences when this law was enacted. And 413.30F1 says that an adjustment is made only to the extent the costs are reasonable, attributable to circumstances specified, separately identified by the provider, and verified by the intermediary. And we fit every single one of those categories. And there's really no dispute that we fit every single one of those categories. Now, I'd like to talk about the 94 policy that came out. This was a stealth rulemaking. I mean, not only was it not notice and comment, you wouldn't have known that it happened. We included the very last page of our brief in the addendum, the transmittal announcing the 94 policy change. There's not a word of any change in policy at all, and indeed it holds itself out as helping skilled nursing facilities in doing their exception request. And the government's relying upon the Fox case, and frankly that baffles me, because Judge Scalia in the Fox case said, an agency may not, for example, depart from prior policy sub silentio. And elsewhere in the decision, the court credited the FCC with forthrightly acknowledging that its recent actions had broken new ground. Same opinion repeated well-established law that an agency must show that there are good reasons for the new policy. So CMS is, or the Secretary, is requesting deference here when there's been no opportunity to scrutinize its policy through the rulemaking process.
What's your answer to, you rely on the Sacramento decision?
Yes, sir.
As a definitive statement. They say, well, that predated the statute. It predates the 84 decision, and so...
It interpreted the atypical services. It was an atypical services exception case.
And it hasn't changed since then?
Yeah. The wording of the atypical services exception has not changed from, I believe, 1979.
Are there any decisions, are there any more Sacramento decisions
after
1995?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor, because hospitals and skilled nursing facilities were getting the full amount of relief until this 1994 policy.
I see. And what's your reaction to this provision of the manual. I'm looking for the number.
2534?
No. 2927C6E, which they says these things aren't binding.
Oh.
Yeah.
I believe in Shalala v. Guernsey Memorial Hospital from the Supreme Court, the court expressly referred to how the agency, back then the Healthcare Financing Administration, uh-huh. did use adjudications to arrive at policy. There's when also another
agency. Was this added to the manual after that decision? No?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. Uh-huh. Oh, what was...
That language.
That language, this provision that I cited you from the PRB. When was that added? Do we know?
I have no idea.
Yeah. Okay.
Now,
thanks.
The 1979 rulemaking also had a statement in it which says, if a provider receives an exception, it is reimbursed on the basis of the cost limit plus an incremental sum for the reasonable cost warranted by the circumstances that justified the exception. And that's another agency statement in a rulemaking that predated by far, obviously, the 1994 rule change. With respect to the St. Francis decision in the Sixth Circuit that the government has relied upon very heavily, we note first that there was a vigorous dissent on a rulemaking basis.
It doesn't matter. What a dissent does is tell you what the law of the circuit isn't.
Well, I'll close by requesting that the court affirm Judge Urbina's decision.
You're not going to talk about retroactivity.
Well,
you have an argument.
No, we certainly do, Your Honor. I think that our other arguments are sufficiently strong, but.
You're not abandoning that, are you?
Certainly not. The cost incurred here and the decision to incur those costs was 1991 and 1993. The manual didn't come out until July 1994, so we have reliance. And it clearly is retroactive. I think it's just sophistry to refer to.
Did you make a record about, for example, budgeting on the part of the hospital in anticipation of being reimbursed for costs incurred at the time, and that the to then disallow them a number of years later after you've already incurred them?
We don't have a record addressing that specifically, Your Honor, nor do I suspect. I don't know that there was a record about how the lodge operators and Alaska Professional Hunters had specifically relied upon the FAA policy.
It was a record.
Okay.
Because the FAA had conducted a rulemaking proceeding and then decided not to promulgate a rule. But during that rulemaking proceeding, they made a pretty extensive record, as a matter of fact.
If no further questions, your time's up anyway. So.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Perfect. It zeroed out, just as you said. Thank you, Your Honor. Now, we'll have to give you back some time for rebuttal, so you've got 2 minutes for rebuttal, Mr. Steinmeier.
I won't have to take it all. Let me just deal with the terms routine costs and atypical services, because Judge Randolph's question said, well, they're routine costs, and then they're atypical costs.
Is that wrong?
Well, yes, and maybe the easiest way is just to the very last page of my brief uses the same chart that Montefiore came up with. They're costs for routine services. The routine services are things like food, nursing, things that patients routinely get when they go to a hospital. And they're reimbursed up to their cost limit on that. Then there's an exception that if a hospital can show that it performed atypical services of some kind, atypical services, then it can get more a reimbursement above that routine cost limit. And that's where the reimbursement gets. So we're not talking about atypical costs or somehow something different with respect to nursing and food and administration. No, they're all the same. Up to the cost limit, they're reimbursed. But if they perform atypical services with respect to those same routine costs, then the exception provision can apply. Our key point throughout has been it's written in permissive language. Both the statute and the regulation say the secretary may do this, and it, not that it has to. The only mandate is if you're going to provide compensation above the cost limit for atypical services, you can't pay for unreasonable services. And what the secretary did here was said, now we don't have the report in the record. Okay, that's fine. But
yeah, but what do you mean that's fine? How can we have a decision? How can we review a decision that is based on a report that isn't in the record?
You can look at what Congress did. The report was to Congress, and who cares what's in it?
Well,
as a result, Congress made a decision. Right. As a result, Congress made a decision. We're cutting back on what we pay hospital-based service. Now, what's the only possible explanation that comes from it? Did they think hospital-based nursing facilities had some alternative source of money? They didn't need money the way freestanding did? No, they thought it was inefficient. That's what the secretary did.
They didn't think about it. I mean, we now know that congressmen don't read legislation.
Well, you got me there, Your Honor. But unfortunately, judges do have to read it. And I would ask, when you read the statute, it says you cut back. And so what the secretary says, well, we're not going to pay through the back door. What Congress said, don't pay through the front door. And we're doing it on a systemic basis. And I don't have to show that's the best way. It's a permissible way.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted. Give us recess.